You're listening to Bit by Bit, July 23rd, 2010.
This is Zoe Sprankle reporting from North Station in Boston, Massachusetts, and I was at the BLC conference.
And what does that stand for?
Building Learning Community.
Good.
Sorry. So on Wednesday, me and my dad went to a workshop.
July 14th. It feels like ages ago.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And we saw Dean Shurinsky.
I'll say it. We saw Dean Shurinsky, my good friend Dean Shurinsky, and what was his topic?
When you're not the smartest person in the room, which is very true because teachers sometimes aren't the smartest people in the room.
What?
It's the kids.
You sure?
Yes.
A great talk. You're going to really enjoy this. Thanks to Dean for letting us podcast it. Keep checking back. We'll have the other workshops from the Building Learning Communities Conference in Boston, summer of 2010.
Everybody, my name is Pascal Swartz. I am from Winslow, Maine. I attend Winslow High School, and this is Dean Shurinsky. He's going to be presenting When You're Not the Smartest Person in the Room.
Thank you. So, what happened? Did you guys not get into other sessions, or were they full, or what?
We're smart,
you
know.
Pardon me?
We're smart enough to know the difference.
Yeah, right. Somebody said before said that there has never been a more perfect title for a presenter than that one for me, and I tend to agree. That's the case. But seriously, I have a little trouble sometimes when you're putting together these kinds of presentations, and then you're supposed to put a description down and get folks to sort of be enticed by that one. And I really wasn't all that happy with the way mine turned out. That's my own fault. But I'm curious in terms of why you're here. Like, what kind of things are you sort of interested in? What's sort of rattling around your brain in terms of the kinds of concepts that, I mean, other than the fact that I'm sure you probably just couldn't get into other sessions. So if you're one of those folks, I understand you're just here to find a seat. But if you actually did come thinking that, yeah, there's some things that I'm thinking about, what are those kinds of things? Just a couple of people just sort of, sure, talk to me.
I like having, you know, parents come in who are experts about something, but it would be nice to be able to do that through Skype,
sure,
or through other.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Yes?
I come from a school where the model is the teacher is the most important person in the room, and what I'm hoping to get out of this are steps to get teachers to want to not be.
I don't think that's the only district that believes that. Somebody else? Yes?
You know,
how do we sort of leverage that? And make
right,
that?
Like what are some different ways to help empower them to look into it more?
Sure.
Or pull all of that into the classroom because they certainly don't know everything they're
talking
about.
One more, yeah.
Due to events in the last couple of days, I'm feeling really, really stupid right now. So I figured it's just been
it's had for you. All right, well, and actually all those things are perfect and will, I hope, fit in with what I want to do and what we're going to do as a group here in the next hour or so. So thank you for sharing that and just giving me that context about, there's a couple of seats right up front and a few over there if folks want to join in. Anyways, really, really privileged and thankful to have to have you come. And so just a little bit about my background, kind of have a neat perspective on things. Not only do I have four kids and a dog and those kind of things, and I come from a land not down under but way up north in Canada, and that actually has some different perspectives and nuances than folks from How many of you are not from the United States in here? Grab and one, well, three of you. So most of you have that. So perhaps there's some little differences around that. I don't know. My main role is working in a school district in Saskatchewan, which, if you're geographically challenged, think Montana, North Dakota, right that border, and then go straight up. That's kind of where you'd find me. Working in a school division of 7,000 students or so, 500 teachers, not boxes and wires, just working with the technology and a bunch of other stuff too, because probably like all of you, you don't have enough capacity, and so that they always like to give you extra little jobs. Oh, one job that I don't have anymore that I had last year was sexual health. Talk about not the smartest person in the room. That's always. I have four kids. I don't really, but that really isn't any claim to fame in that regard. Anyways, so I do that, but also I've been privileged over the last few years and I'm going to talk a little bit about that in my talk today to teach pre-service teachers at our local university, and that's a course, a couple of different courses that's really sort of about looking at technology, and you can't believe. I mean, probably some of you are aware, and I see some of you are of a generation, of a younger generation, who have just probably, how many of you have graduated from your college in the last 10 years? A few of you, yeah. And how many of you felt like you were really well prepared to understand the use of technology in teaching? A couple of you. I'm finding that most of those folks aren't. And so while we have this great hope that, oh, these young folks will come in and they have these great skills and understandings, it's not so much the case. And so a lot of the things that I talk about with my students are brand new. The idea of, what do you mean, like bringing somebody in by Skype? That, like, I mean, those kind of things are foreign to them. Haven't even considered that, because so much of what those colleges teach are exactly what this gentleman said before, around they're the smartest, they have to be the expert, and so they're panicked around feeling like they have to be incredibly knowledgeable. So that's just a very interesting perspective, I think, that I have on education in general. I'm fortunate to be able to practice a lot of the things that I'm wanting teachers to do. I get a chance to do that in a classroom setting, so I feel really fortunate to be able to do that. One of the powerful things about today's world, and Alan kind of addressed it a little bit at the beginning as he talked about sort of the shift in the way that we communicate, is I really want this conversation that we're having today to continue so that it doesn't end at 11:30 and then we're done. If you come out of here and a week later something hits you, or 10 minutes later, or a year later, I want that conversation to continue. To continue in various spaces with me via email, my blog, or on Twitter. Those are probably the three most, I mean, Skype as well. There's all kinds of ways that you can contact me. And I don't say that in any, I don't say that, but with the most sincerest tone, in that I really want those conversations to continue. And those conversations to continue, even in terms of, I don't know if I agreed with that. And I think in education we get a little bit, we're almost too nice. And we don't push back some of the thoughts. It was interesting, even in Mitch Resnick's talk this morning, I happened to be on Twitter following some conversations, and there were immediately some ideas that were brought to my attention that I thought, wait a minute, I'm not sure what I think about this. And so that's the kind of thing, those are the kinds of conversations that really don't get resolved in an hour and 15 minutes. They really do take the time. So when I say those are areas to contact me, I really mean that. So push my thinking, and hopefully I can push yours. Let's start off just with a few, just doing a little bit of activity with the people around you. I want you just right now to think about who are some of the smartest people you know. So just have a conversation with the person beside you, around you, for about 2 minutes. That was great. Seems like a smart guy, right?
restaurant. Restaurant. You too, Dean.
Alright, I realize that's a maybe not a great question in some respects, but how many of you can share someone else's answer that you thought was pretty wide, a good answer, or interesting answer that you wouldn't have thought of? Share somebody else's, maybe not yours. Yes?
Her son.
Her son? Neat. How old is your son?
10.
I like that. Anybody else share somebody else's? Yes?
This gentleman talked about his mother, who makes wedding dresses and has to redesign them quickly and process information quickly. And
right, so you're looking at a specific skill of someone saying, wow, that's some wisdom I could should be able to tap into at some point. One more person. Yes?
I'll read that. She said the generations before us and after us, because they seem to be really absorbing everything, and the generation before us, so much.
I really like that. That's a great perspective, and I hope I can even bring some of that in there. That sometimes we get pretty egocentric, just in our own generation, right? That we've kind of we grew up in just stuff that we know and have experienced, and I think that's something that, especially as we look at technology, and I think about some of the questions that we're facing right now in terms of. There's this negative side about using technology. Are we overconnected? Do we rely on it too much? And so you get this pushback in this one direction, and then yet at the same time, generally speaking, those of you here are very much advocating the use of it. So again, but it's seen through our lens when you kind of have this historical background, which I'm going to talk about. I think that's really important, that history, and yet looking at our 10-year-olds and our 5-year-olds in terms of Let's if we possibly can, imagine what their world's going to be like in 20 years. So that's a great perspective. I want to talk about three things today. I'm going to give you kind of a background from my perspective in terms of where kind of we've gone and where I think we are now. Again, this is sort of my take on things. And then I want to talk about looking at the outside and finding those people outside that can be a part of our learning and what that could look like for our schools and our classrooms. And then looking inside and thinking about, okay, we have some pretty smart people right in our midst. How can we leverage that? And that was the kind of question that this young lady was asking before about how to do that. So those are the three parts that I want to kind of talk about this morning. So first of all, how did we get here? This is my first year teaching, 1988. Taught grade one, can you believe it? In fact, my daughter said, so were you the assistant or whatever? And actually, no, that was actually a teaching assistant on the far right side. That was my first class. It's amazing how I've been teaching now for 22 years in education, and I could pretty well name, I went and looked at that picture, and I could pretty well name every kid in that picture. I probably couldn't do that in my fourth or fifth year, but the first one you always remember. And I thought about the differences in that classroom. And that young boy there, his name was Bradley. And I actually taught on a military base in Canada. I don't know if you're familiar with the snowbirds flying thing. That's where they do that stuff there. And his dad was a pilot he's actually an American, a kid from Texas who was there on a sort of an exchange thing. His dad was, I think, a Blue Angel pilot guy or whatever. Anyways, Bradley was already reading way beyond any other kid in my classroom. So here I am, first year teaching first grade, thinking that my job was to teach them how to read. He already could. So my brain was sort of racked with, whoa, what do I do now? Because he already knows how to read. Michael in the corner there, Michael was a piece of work. I'm sure he's incarcerated. I am absolutely sure. I mean, there were some serious, in fact, that's the reason why I had a teaching assistant in that classroom, is because largely because he had huge behavior problems. I mean, just bizarre. So again, you're a first year teacher, you know, trying, and now you have got this kid who's doing, you know, he's taking the scissors and cutting the back of kids' sweaters and rubbing glue on people's pants and killing fish. Oh, I mean, it was just bizarre stuff he did. And I mean, I had no idea what to do with him. Christina never smiled, and you can see in that picture, she never smiled. So my whole goal that year was just to make this kid laugh. Like, she just seemed like this kid that, not, you know, just had this grumpy look on her face, and I mean, I met her parents, I can understand why, but, you know, that was sort of looking at this, how do I help this little child find joy in learning in school? And finally, you know, I had Lacey, who, Lacey liked to draw unicorns. Like, she would have really liked the Scratch thing if Scratch was available. But that's all she did, was draw unicorns. So when we were doing math, she drew unicorns. When we did science, she drew unicorns. And I'd say, Lacey, you got to do more than just draw unicorns. And she'd smile at me, yes, sir, and she'd just draw unicorns again. So that's all she did. So here, one of the things that was happening just from our province in terms of educational initiatives was a couple of ideas that just for me were completely elusive. I had no idea what to do with them. This word individualized instruction. You know, and there, so they talk about individualized instruction. I'm looking at these 25 or 26 students and thinking, how in the world do I do that? And again, trying to give you a background about that. And the other one was this adaptive dimension. Today, I think we would probably coin both of those phrases in differentiation. How many of you have used the word differentiation in your districts a lot lately? It's a pretty big word, right? And I mean, I think it's a great idea. And largely, today we have, I believe, now I'm starting to understand how that's possible. Many of those ideas leveraged by the computers that you're holding right now is providing some of that potential to make that a reality. 22 years ago, man, that was just, I don't know what you mean by individualized instruction. I'd read what they'd said, here's what you could do. No, that can't happen. You've never been in my classroom. You've never had to deal with Michael and Lacey and Bradley. And the other thing was a culture that was very isolated. And still, to some degree, as teachers, it is a very isolated profession. And one of the things that I deal with in my district is that we're pretty diverse geographically, and so we've got some small little schools of 100 students K-12, and you are the only person that teaches grade 3 and 4. You have no other colleagues. Now, even in larger schools, I'm not so sure there's a lot of difference as well, but there was definitely that feeling of you're all alone, and how in the world do I make this happen? Given all of the challenges that I have with teaching and learning. And I guess the thing that sort of strikes you as a little bit odd is that we've kind of lost along the way, again, historically, the whole idea of community. When you think about, you know, people in the early part of the 20th century with where they were doing barn raising and things like that, and there was just much more of a, seemed to be more of a spirit of community, where people would gather together and just help one another out. That just was a natural part of society. I read a great book called Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, and that middle picture sort of signifies the idea, and his premise is basically that people actually are bowling now more than ever. They're just not bowling in leagues anymore. They're bowling by themselves. And I mean, there's a lot of factors that have sort of contributed to the culture that we have now where you know, people are isolated. I was doing a workshop in Portland earlier in the year, and I was so excited. I walked down the street, and I was visiting with a friend of mine who lives there, and I was noticing, we're building a house right now, okay, just a little bit of a backstory. And one of the things that we didn't want to do with our house is, I don't know if you, where you live, you have these garage houses, where there's a huge garage in front, and then the house is at the back. And that's just because when you only have a 50-foot lot or whatever, if you're going to have a two-car garage, and you don't have a back alley, you have to build this. We didn't want that. And in Portland, they actually have a law that says you can't do that, and it's about building community. That's the reason why. In fact, the law actually has some, I can't remember the name of it, but it has to do with the fact that we want to encourage people to be out front, you know, like neighborhoods where people sit on their porches and visit as people go by. That was sort of looking back to this nostalgic era of the 50s and so forth, where people did those kinds of things, where you knew your neighbors, you talked to them. That's been lost. as we've sort of become, our desire to be more self-sufficient, and I mean, again, there's lots of factors in the book that talks about that. And the other one was the pop-in, right? I grew up in a community where people did pop in. All of a sudden, it's 8 o'clock, there's a knock on the door, it's somebody that says, yeah, we were up for a drive and thought we'd stop in for coffee. They didn't phone, they didn't do anything else. That doesn't happen anymore. You've got to make arrangements 2 weeks ahead. I'll check my calendar and we'll see. Maybe we can meet somehow. That's just not part of our culture today, in that we do those kinds of things. So I believe there's this whole societal loss of community, and in some ways that's been infiltrating our school. Now what's interesting now is that with the advent of social networking, I mean, that's one of the reasons why people are so excited about this, is because this is one way in which we can restore and regain some sense of community. It's not the same, but it's really that desire in us to connect with other people. But in our schools, we've continued to talk about a mind your own business style of learning, where you sit by yourself, you learn individually, you work individually, you don't look at your neighbor's work, you don't talk to your neighbor, you mind your own business. And even in the workplace, that's been the case as well, that we've perpetuated the idea of mind your own business. And you know, part of it is, again, I think that we do what we do until we know better. And if you're familiar with that, this ad says, blow in her face and she'll follow you anywhere. I mean, I think that's absurd, right? But we, at the time when that was probably produced, it was, hey, this is a great way to promote smoking, awesome, right? But we know better now, and I think we do know better when it comes to the ways in which we can start to build the idea of community in our classrooms, and again, largely because of this kind of stuff. The connectivity that we have now enables us to go beyond our classroom walls, to start thinking about individualized instruction, to start thinking about adaptive dimension, and all those terms that, again, for me, it felt like I have no idea what these are. I'm starting to see the possibilities because of our ability to be connected. You talked about a 10-year-old being your teacher, and I think today, when we ask the question, who's your teacher? That becomes an interesting question, because in some cases it could be an MIT physicist. This is Walter Lewin, who has all of his physics lectures online. I don't know a thing about physics, but I sure enjoy watching his lectures. He's a fantastic instructor and does all kinds of wonderful demonstrations. Or it could be a 10-year-old from the UK who's just willing to share his knowledge about green screening.
Hi guys, today I'm going to do a Pinnacle Studio 12 Ultimate tutorial, and it's going to be a green screen tutorial. And I got the inspiration from Hughes Film Limited's Final Cut green screen tutorial. So I hope you enjoy it. And I finally got a remote for the camera. So when I can like stop and start and stuff. So yeah, it's cool.
So the great thing about these kinds of little tutorials
is
the fact that here he is in his bedroom by himself, has an idea, he wants to share it, he does it, he turns on the camera, you know, he's humming and hawing and showing his remote and doing all this other stuff. I mean, it's not like he's going to take time to have this high production value. He just wants to share what he knows. And specifically, this tutorial was one I used a year or so ago, as someone was asking me, how do you do this stuff? You go on YouTube, you do a little search, you find out, oh, here's a 10-year-old that's doing it, you watch it, and you learn it, and you say, hey, now I mean, that's the kind of thing that we now can experience, and we don't think anything of it, that 10-year-olds can have an opportunity to teach. Oh, and by the way, you carry this around in your pocket too, right? You carry these teachers around in your pocket wherever you go. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to write down or think of three people who have been your teachers in the past month. Now, if they're more than 20 years younger or live in another country, they'll give you bonus points for that. And if you could use this URL, this would be great. Go to wallwisher.com/wall/BLC10smart. And if you have a laptop and can post your ideas there, that's great. But I just want to give you a couple of minutes. Yes?
Could you read that again?
Sorry, yeah, it's at the bottom of the screen here. wallwisher.com/wall/BLC10smart. So just on your own for a minute, and then I'll just have you share with all of us here just a second, if you can think of three people who have been your teachers in the last month or so. It could be all kinds of contexts. Feel free to use your imagination. What have you learned? All right, who's been your teacher? Who can tell me a teacher in the last, give me the learning context and who the teacher was. All kinds of spaces and places. Yes?
My son, James.
What did he teach you?
He taught me how to play Wipeout on the Wii.
How old is James?
He's 8.
There you go. Yes? What?
I teach technology class. Actually, the students teach technology class. I'm just the one in the room to make sure they don't do anything illegal. And one of my students taught me how to do 3D modeling to make a movie trailer.
Nice.
And he did it, and then he linked it to me on Vimeo and on YouTube.
Awesome. Opportunities for more teaching. Some folks from the back of the room. Anybody from another, found some teachers from another country? You get bonus points for that. If not, who else? Yes?
A student of mine taught me how to do Sudokus.
Cool. Well, what would he have to teach you about that? Like a trick or something, a little tip?
He taught me all the little tricks of it, because I'm really not.
Give me a trick.
One of my students, a 13-year-old boy, taught me how to do a butterfly. Taught me to do a lot of outdoor work in our school, and I needed to know how to do that. So
was he like a
scout?
His
father does a lot of outdoor work, and so he's learned a lot from his dad. He's pretty happy to share it with him.
Absolutely.
My fifth graders are teaching me all the time, obviously, but this one, I was trying to open United Streaming in Mozilla, and I couldn't go full screen. And one of the kids said, "You can't do it in Mozilla. You'll have to go to Internet Explorer." He was like putting up with me. So I went into Internet Explorer, and all of a sudden it went full screen. So he knew that it wouldn't open up. And
so these examples of students teaching, and I'm so glad that you recognize those and make a point of remembering that. I mean, those. The kind of thing you state happens all the time. It's not like that's new. But the fact that you identify that, recognize that, and acknowledge that in your classrooms now brings the opportunity up that changes the nature of how the learning is going to happen, right? That you're not the expert, that others can actually make those contributions. One more? Yes?
My auto mechanic showed me where under my hood I could take a fuse out to change it from four-wheel drive to front-wheel drive during the summer to save gas.
Nice that he did that. I mean, there's some generosity, right? Because he, you know, you, those mechanics, right? They're sneaky, and sometimes
not mine.
That's right. That's awesome, Liz. You had your hand up. Sorry.
My learning network through Twitter or other online sources teaches me things all the time.
Right, and that's sometimes hard to even identify, single out this person or that person, because sometimes these ideas become sort of mixed and they're in the air, they're floating, but. We acknowledge, I mean, it's easy to go to YouTube and say, well, that kid taught me that. But there's these other ideas that are sort of community ideas that we need to acknowledge the fact that they do come from a source. They're not just sort of loosely, they are loosely developed, and we can't maybe identify a specific. But we need to acknowledge the fact that these are generated from people working together. And I think that's maybe a difference, too, in the fact that we have the ability now to attach meaning and resources to people. And so I don't know if it becomes more valuable or just easier to attribute, because we know we can now connect to the individuals that have made that video. I can go on his video and leave a comment, whereas before, if you showing a video in your classroom, you know, on a VHS or other kinds of tape, there's this distance between the creator, and so there was no reason to attribute. Now we do. Yes, one more. Yeah, the remix culture is, it comes with some interesting interesting dynamics, that being one of them. But certainly, I think, and I'm glad that we talked about mechanics and knots and other things outside of school, because I think that's a really significant thing for us to recognize. Probably has always been true, but I think we need to be thinking that school is not just the primary place of learning. That learning is not about what happens in school, necessarily. And we've been talking lifelong learning for a long time. Probably a bunch of you've got lifelong learning as a mission statement somewhere, place. What does that mean? How are we modeling that to our students if we think that the only learning that's going to happen is going to happen in the building? And so I think school still plays a huge role in this, but it's just definitely not the only one anymore. I like this quote about school. Being good at school is a fine skill if you intend to do school forever. For the rest of us, being good at school is a little like being good at Frisbee. It's nice, but it's not relevant. And I mean, I threw that one in there because I think that's interesting. So the question still becomes is how do we begin to move past an educational model that is tethered to time and place and move closer to learning that is immersive, mobile, collaborative, and social? Those are some big ideas. If you want to just take each one of those, immersive learning, mobile, collaborative, social, we could spend days and hours on each one of those terms trying to unwrap what that means and decide for ourselves, yeah, that's my vision. And I'm hoping that for some of you, you're very clearly there. That's your vision of what you want school to look like. You're trying to get there. For others of you, just the way it is, and there's nothing wrong with it. We're still trying to understand, is that really the learning environment that we want to advocate and build for? So that's kind of the background of kind of where I'm at. So let's go into some those two specific ways, kind of going outside and then looking at the inside. So going outside. So how do we now begin to look at how do we leverage and take advantage of the resources that we have available to us outside of learning? Two things about that video I think I like. I like the idea that it's playful, that learning is this playful, but also that it's seamless. That idea that those other kids were in another country, that wasn't even part of let's acknowledge this is somehow amazing. And you know, you can just see it sort of in the back of the room. This kid decides to go into a staring contest, and so you know he's not part of the learning, but it's just part of the space. And that concept I think is just so powerful that we would actually be able to tap in to people from all kinds of spaces as a natural part of the way in which we learn. And there aren't very many classrooms that have kind of fully grasped that idea. School is no longer constrained to how far the bus can travel in the morning. Schools will be the last to notice. That's a friend of mine said that. I hope schools won't be the last to notice, but that's just an important part. It doesn't matter where you go or how far you can go. That's not where learning and education can happen. We need to be thinking about advocating this, the idea that there isn't any walls. And this is actually a picture that I took going to one of our schools, and I kept passing this picture of this house that was sort of half finished, and I thought I got to take a picture of that somehow. Somehow I knew there was a metaphor there that I wanted to share. But that's the idea, that we wouldn't have those walls in our classrooms, that we would have this idea of openness and the feel that our students would feel empowered, that it's an open thing. But the thing I think that's important for us to recognize is that before we think about that for our classrooms, we need to think about that for ourselves. So, I mean, traditionally, this is the typical teacher network, right? Everything was pretty much one way. The documents, the media, print resources. The only times we had sort of a two-way interaction was with our colleagues locally and perhaps with family and local community. That's a pretty traditional model of how a teacher is networked, but it can and should look like that, where so much of, and Liz kind of identified that as she talked about her learning network and kind of how these ideas are moving in and out very fluidly. That's the kind of idea that I think as teachers we need to experience for ourselves, because I really have a hard time believing that we're going to actually start doing these things in our classrooms if we don't have an experience for this on ourselves. Will Richardson talks about, as educators, that we need to think of ourselves as connectors first and content experts second. I find that to be extremely the case when I mentioned before with these teachers that are teaching high schools and they're teaching six different courses as compared to, you know, a high school teacher that might teach just a history teacher. That's my area of expertise. I can kind of hone in on that. But when you're a teacher teaching four or five or six, sometimes different courses, they kind of get this very, very quickly. And so they just fall in love with the concept of being a connector because they've just given up. The question is whether the history teacher that's been teaching history for 20 years begins to think of themselves as a connector, or are they still the expert? That's a good question, and it's not to deny the fact that we don't need experts. We shouldn't have expertise, but at the same time, what's our ability to connect? I'll tell you a great story of a teacher actually in New Jersey who's teaching Spanish and decided to teach Spanish by asking all of the students what they were interested in. And so one girl says, well, I'm interested in fashion design. So he connected her with a couple of blogs in Spain, and part of her assignment was to comment regularly on these fashion blogs out of Spain. In the meantime, one of these bloggers happened to want to learn English, and so there was an exchange where this high school student was able to teach this fashion designer some English. And so, I mean, what a powerful way. And again, he would have no problem teaching her Spanish, but the idea that he could connect her to her area of passion and learn in a way that was much more meaningful to her is the kind of things that we should be thinking about as we think about our students and what our roles are for them. And again, this is about you, first of all, having that understanding of what this connected world looks like. And there's tons of different sessions out there. If this is kind of a new concept to you, I'd really strongly suggest you look at your program and you find some of those other sessions that might kind of help you understand this a little better, because I'm just kind of briefly touching on this. So this is a crude graphic that I made about 3 years ago, where I took people who I learned from all the time. And some of these people I had met, some of these people had no idea who I was, but I considered them my teachers, and I called it my research team. So I put these little funky lab coats. A lot of people were kind of freaked out about this. You know, I admit, it's kind of crude and perhaps a little spooky. But for me, it's a concept that is a little bit more an easier sell to teachers. Sometimes you'll hear the word PLN, Personal Learning Network. I have some problem with that term in some ways, and it's not a big deal, but I just find I'm thinking of ways in which I can sort of capture what this does. And for me, especially at this point in time when I first began, these are people that were doing research for me. And so what that meant is they were bookmarking sites, for example. But I had access to their bookmarking sites because they shared them. So I felt like they were actually doing research for me all the time. So I'd wake up in the morning and I would go to that bookmarking site or my RSS feed, and I'd see all the things that they had bookmarked overnight. Because some of those people were in Australia and some of those people were in different parts of the world. And it was like free research. Hey, wow, this is awesome that they can find that stuff for me. So that sort of that was a seed for me that really began thinking about, wow, this is awesome that I can do this. And now I can start to tweak and hone, because this person, after a while, you know what? They're nice people and all, but they're not finding the things that I need, that I'm interested in. But I can find somebody else who now is finding the kind of information that I'm looking for. And it may be for a short period of time. It may be people that I think are doing great things over time. Whatever. It's very fluid and flexible. But that was a really, really important thing for me. So I talked about one of the things that I wanted to do was help, when I began teaching this university class, help those pre-service teachers understand this one. So this is sort of the journey that I took them on. I had, in my class, I had sort of five big ideas in my class. But the one that I sort of wanted to focus on with them is that learning is social and connected. Now again, that's a pretty broad statement. What does that mean? We need to flesh that out and understand what that means, that learning is social and connected. And so that was just a theme that ran throughout the course and that we refer to back over time to understand what does that actually mean? What does that look like? And so I began to think about how I could take these students and help them feel like they understood that learning is social and connected. So, as I mentioned before, the Spanish teacher connecting them with people, that was one of the first thing I did. So I put out a cry to people that I knew, and I said, listen, I have got 20 students in my class. They all have, some of them were elementary focused, others were math majors. They're all over the map, so there weren't any kind of a homogeneous group. So I said, would you be willing to mentor them? So we talked about what mentoring was. So basically what happened was, and I've done this now for about a number of different terms, is they've opened up their classrooms. So all of these teachers around the world have some sort of a presence online, some way in which my students could peer into their classrooms and look at the kinds of things that they were doing in their classrooms, and in some ways, almost like a student-teaching relationship. Now, the University of Regina, where I teach part-time, has a very, compared to other teacher colleges, has a very high rate of in-class practicum. So they do a lot of, you know, they're in there more than in a lot of other programs. But this is another one of those ways to do that. And so I hooked them up. So they were able to do, and they did a myriad of kinds of things. This is one of my students Skyping into a teacher, actually in the Boston area, doing a little lesson online. So they would actually teach online. They got to know these kids online. They got to see what it was like. And then I connected them with two or three classrooms. So they had quite a variety of experience looking at, and some of them I said, pick something that is specific to your area. So if you're going to be an elementary teacher, hook up with an elementary teacher. But pick another area that's completely out of context for you. So go into a math class. See what a high school calculus class looks like and have that experience. That was pretty scary for some of them, but really powerful as well. One of my students said, I couldn't put enough words how much I gained from this experience. Lorraine Leo was her name, was a great person to work with. I learned a lot about what I wanted to do in my future classroom as well. And so what a great experience for them to have this connection, never met these people at all, and yet felt somehow connected to the kinds of things that they were doing and experiences that they had. Very, very powerful kinds of things. And that doesn't just happen. So that was my sort of one of the things that I did to kind of help draw out the idea of being social and being connected. But there's tons of other examples. Kathy Cassidy, who's actually doing a session here with two other teachers, primary teachers, does this all the time. She teaches first grade, studying rocks. Pretty easy to put a lesson together on rocks. But she thought, wouldn't it be better to have somebody was an expert in rocks. So she went out on, she used Twitter, and she said, hey, does anybody know, first of all, she contacted our local universities, the geology department, and, you know, kind of got the runaround, and it wasn't looking really good. Kind of put it out on Twitter all of a sudden, you know, one person says, well, I know somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody, and pretty soon we have Dr. Greg from the University of Oregon Skype in to first graders to tell them about rocks. And the interesting thing was she's been dying to work in classrooms in Oregon, and no one's ever asked her. And yet here is a teacher in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, who's just dying to have her in here. So she's done this a couple of years now where she comes in and the kids ask, you know, the typical first grade questions, and she just does a wonderful job speaking with them and answering their questions. And I mean, it's just, that is just a natural part of that classroom, that we need somebody on rocks. Let's get somebody in that knows something about rocks and talk to our kids about that. Just a really, really neat experience. Lee Colbert is actually here as well, and Lee had a scientist in talking about, it was kind of the idea called the secret life of scientists, so sort of breaking down the stereotypes of what a scientist is. The scientist that she had in is actually a model, too, and so especially to sort of appeal to the girls in a fourth grade classroom, that scientists isn't just for geeky people, that all kinds of people are interested in science. And again, it developed a relationship where Lee was doing some, they kind of just were able to move beyond just this one-time pop in and actually build a relationship with them. Another good friend of mine, Clarence Fisher from Northern Manitoba, had Dave Weinberger, who works not far from here, Skype in and talk about network and sort of what the web is for. He's got a children's kind of version of what the web is for. And I love that I put even from here because that's Clarence's blog. And one of the things that he advocates is the fact that we live in this isolated community way in the north. But even from here, we can connect and learn and have a voice. And for those kids who grow up in that kind of an isolated community, that's a powerful thing, a message for them to have. And I'm sure lots of us, even in urban centers, if you grew up in a, especially if you're in a lower socioeconomic area, a lot of those kids don't have hope that they can sort of have an impact. And there's ways in which you can sort of provide that message for them that doesn't matter where you live. And sometimes this is about, having that personal connection with the people, but sometimes it's about, you know, even the wonderful resources that are available to us and how do we bring those experts into our classrooms and use those as levels of expertise. A teacher in, I think Clay is in Thailand right now, he uses the TED Talks, which most of you are familiar. If you're not, go to TED.com and spend 3 weeks there. You'll never get out of there. He says, for teaching my students about presentations, TED is my textbook. So thinking differently even about what resources do I have, that's how you will learn about that, not from a textbook and not from traditional resources. So even the ways that in which we think about resources is powerful. Sort of piggybacking on that idea, Christian Long, who's just moved from, he was in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, had his students sort of go through these TED Talks and do some analysis around them and sort of deconstruct and sort of take that textbook idea even further. And I love what Christian says about his role as a teacher. I'm no longer an English teacher. Instead, I'm an agent, social media DJ, and publisher for my kids. And again, trying to wrap your head around what all of those kinds of terms mean and what that looks like as a teacher. That's a powerful statement to think about. What your role is as a teacher. And again, by exposing them to that resource, they're in there doing the digging and the learning. He's just sort of providing the avenues to show them, here's how you publish this online. And he would get people to come in and comment. So he'd send me a message saying, this student has something, I think you could really make a contribution to them. So it takes me 10 minutes. I go onto this kid's blog, I leave a comment. And now something really interesting begins to happen because then this kid asks more questions. And so again, not a big big thing on my part, but I'm hoping a powerful thing for that student to know that other people care about his work and can provide him feedback for learning. So in that way, I become his teacher in a small way. And I mean, he had lots of other people that he connected and brought in. So having this network that you can tap into is such a huge resource for yourself as a teacher to prove that, no, you aren't the smartest person. Other examples, Carl Fish in Colorado brings in Dan Pink, who wrote A Whole New Mind, Skypes them in, and again, does a whole study around them. So, I mean, what's interesting is you think of Dan Pink, who's a pretty well-known author, and yet he's willing to do this for free. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people can't wrap their head around, that, well, people just want to share. There is a culture of sharing that now we can actually tap into. So, again, the idea of community loss, it's not that it's totally lost. We just have a new way to find it. and a new way to bring that out where people can actually make the contributions that they would love to do. So the geologist in Oregon has an avenue to share her good work. I mean, everybody wants to share, but how do we do that and how do we make that happen? It's important. But the common denominator for all of those teachers is this, is that they have that network. That's why they could do those things. That's why it happens, is because you have a network. So again, I would encourage you, if that's something that's a little bit foreign to you, you haven't grasped, look through your program and find those places that are talking specifically about how to make this happen. All right, a task for you. If you have internet access, and I'm going to give you just a few minutes to get this project started, and I'm going to get some other people to help us out with this too. I want you to see if you can collect one or two images of weather around the world that's happened in the past few hours. So I don't know how you're going to find that, and we'll talk about the different strategies that folks would use. But think about now, if I asked you, I want a picture of weather that's happened in the last few hours, anywhere. And again, bonus points if you can get them from another continent. More bonus points if you can get them from an individual in real time. And as soon as you find that picture, could you email them to this site right here? Now that, I hope that, it's csee56vary@photos.flickr.com. So I realize if you don't have a laptop, you'll be staring in space for a while. We won't do this. I'm just curious to see how folks would be able to tackle a task like that.
So has anybody ever told you that you look like Steve Nash?
Has anybody ever told you?
Yeah.
No, I don't know Steve Nash.
He does.
Canada. He looks like
this.
Do you know all this?
No.
Do you know Peter?
He doesn't like to
show. Does he?
Yeah.
You
need to
like,
you
little,
you
need to
be
a little scruffy.
Yeah.
He's not very tall.
Just rough yourself up a bit.
I'll bring him for his dinner reservation.
There you go.
Do you want us to email you the link, or do you want us to email
the actual picture, the actual photo, if you can? Because
what
this. This URL is a personal URL on my Flickr site, so what will happen is if you just put, whatever you put the subject, so if the subject was weather from China or whatever, that would be the title of the photo, and the photo would be embedded, if you have the photo as an attachment, it will actually show up on my Flickr page with the name of the photo, as I said, the subject being the title of the photo, and then the photo. And if you add any text in the... Well, that would do that. Probably, you know what? So, just curious for those of you that are working, or even if you're not working at that, tell me a little bit about the process that you went to sort of gather this information. What did you do? Yes? And what did you come up with?
I came with the BBC weather site, and it has news worldwide.
So it was very easy to find really quickly? Okay. Anybody else take a different route?
I can't because I'm not online now, but I have some friends in China. Probably China, which is online right now. Usually, so I would call her up and say, would send me a shot.
So your connection is, would you say Skype?
Skype or Twitter.
Okay. Anybody else have a different strategy?
Yes.
Weather channel? Right there. Pardon me, Facebook? Sure. Snap a photo for me. Bob?
Flickr?
So how do you search in Flickr?
So I went to Flickr, put weather, then I did advanced search, put today's date, and Nancy von Wald, who is a friend I saw that she had a weather photo, probably because you Twittered out earlier.
Maybe.
Maybe responding
maybe.
To, so yeah.
Yeah, that's a good, I hadn't thought of that one. So, I mean, what's interesting, of course, is that just even the process by which we would kind of come up with those ones, again, I think is fascinating. So, you know, whether it's the Weather Channel or Google or texting a friend or looking on Flickr. Sorry, am I in the way? Bing, or yeah, I mean, there's. Sure. Do you know how do you know it was today? Okay. Sure. I mean, I think those that process of where you find your expertise and how you bring that in, again, that's a whole other layer to this kind of thing. So as a teacher, I can say, here, I'm going to bring in this person and we'll show you. But the strategies by which we can now tap into our understanding begins to start this process of thinking that there's some expertise in the room that we need to tap into. So let me talk a little bit about looking inside. At no point did I ever consciously think when I was teaching that first grade class that I could actually use the power of each other in the classroom. And I'm sure I did in sort of unintentional ways where you'd have group work and things like that. But it wasn't in my brain that, wow, you can do some great learning from each other. I did group work probably because I thought it was fun or something. You know, I didn't really have a context of why I'm doing this and why that could be valuable. Dave Weinberger said the smartest person in the room is the room. And that becomes I mean, if you put that poster up in your classroom, the smartest person in the room is the room, and you begin to empower your students to think that way, that, again, I think that has some significant impact on how it can change the dynamic of a classroom. All right. Another task for you. Who are they? Don't say anything. Just look at it by yourself. Don't share. Just by yourself. Right now, just on your own, look at those six photos and see if you can figure out by yourself how many of them you can identify. I wish I had a picture of Steve Nash up there, but I don't, that would help. How many can look at those six and identify all six? Five. Four. I'm pretty smart there. You might want to sit beside that lady. Three. You guys really aren't that bright.
Which is why we're here.
Two. Come on, two. One. All right, Zoe, who can you identify?
I don't know if I'm right.
Guess. That's okay.
The lady.
Say her name.
All right, well, we'll go through it. You can tell me if you're right. I put you on the spot. So, far top left.
From the music group.
I thought it was Lance Bass,
yeah.
But I don't think he is.
No. Philippe Cousteau. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. Yes, he is. Jacques Cousteau's son. Top middle.
Ella?
Top right?
J.K. Rowling.
Bottom left? I think I heard somebody say it. Nope. Malakah Begum? Middle? Phil Mickelson? And bottom right? Top one. It's my neighbor. So, again, I mean, I do that again to start to illustrate the idea that we need each other for some of this stuff. And so how can we tap into each other's experiences and knowledge and expertise? So, I mean, encourage you to do things like that with your students to be able to help them to see that, okay, everybody can make a contribution and consider. And again, we're moving to a culture that would suggest that our current generation has no memory of a moment of the internet that we're in right now, that we are suggesting that a participatory learning as a practice is no longer exotic or new, but commonplace, and it's a way of socializing and learning. For many, it seems entirely unremarkable. So when we talk about, and again, I want, go see Brad's session on the myth of the digital native later on, because I tend to agree with his idea that it's not really a digital native. However, their experiences in terms of their expectations, maybe not their skills and abilities, but their expectations that they will learn socially and have access to this stuff is pretty real, and it's going to continue to be real because they've never been in a world where they have not had that kind of access. And they live in a participatory culture where they can post something right away if they want to. That's significant. Actually, it's a picture of a friend of mine, Alec Koros, his little guy. Use that picture. So, again, I think this, my challenge is the socializing and learning and understanding the subtle and not so subtle nuances of social learning online and social learning face-to-face. And because of all this online learning, because if all this online is so effective and so great, then the question has to be asked, what's so good about face-to-face? If we can do all this learning online, why do we need to come together? What's so great about it? And all of us probably earn our paychecks because we belong to institutions that value kids coming together. What I think we've made the mistake is we take for granted that just because the bus comes every day and drops those kids off, we're not tapping into those resources. They're just here. So why is that significant? Why is that important? It becomes really important to me living in a geographically challenged district. When I call a meeting and I bring people who have to drive 2 hours to a meeting, I better darn well not waste their time. And so if you bring them into a meeting and you start reading stuff to them that they're thinking, gee, I could have stayed home for this, that's a waste of money and time. And people just aren't standing for that anymore because they're thinking, we could have done this a lot better. So I think about that all the time. I teach in a hybrid model. So I teach once a week, three times online, once face-to-face. When I get together face-to-face, I think, what are we going to do differently? Because we did some really cool things online because we're online together synchronously. So we go use Illuminate or another thing. We do all kinds of interesting things online. We have small group discussion. There's interaction. I work really hard at trying to make that online environment engaging and enticing, and they do all this other work online. When we're together face-to-face, what's different? What's going to be interesting about being together in a room? I haven't quite figured that out for sure, but it's a question that just is in my mind constantly, is how do I make the use of this? And I mean, if your kids don't have that experience of the online stuff, then of course they take for granted what you do is just those. So we will come in our desks and we'll sit and we'll work and we'll listen and we'll do those things. I think that's going to have to change. A couple of guys who are kind of doing some things different, they're doing what they call homework at school. So Jonathan Bergman and Aaron Sams are physics and math teachers in Colorado. And they developed the model by which they take all of their content for their course in lectures and post them online in podcasts, video and audio podcasts. They distribute them through DVDs, whatever means they need to get it to their kids. So the kids watch the lecture stuff online. They come to school to do the homework. So his role becomes, I'm the connector now. So you already talked about this. What are the problems? What can we work together on? And they're working on this model, and I think it's a really interesting model of school, because now those are the kinds of things that work just as well online as they do offline. And so he, I think, is beginning to address the question about what's so good about face-to-face.
Is that when you would use like Moodle or one of those apps where you literally
all kinds of ways to do it? He just has a website where they just go, it could be a wiki, it could be anything.
Right.
They just click, watch, and that's the homework.
Yeah.
You've got to do that.
And then
we move from there. I mean, I think there's certainly things that we can do that make sense. And I think you know those things, those moments when kids are doing things together that you think, that's awesome. That's great. That's what learning should look like. And that's not to say that you can never have a time where you're lecturing. And I think we have to be really careful about the fact that, I mean, I'm doing it to you right now. So, I realize that's there. Again, that's why I talk about the value of us connecting afterwards as ideas sort of roll through your brain. You talk with each other and moving it beyond that. But I think we really have to be careful about what's so good about face-to-face. One of my students also talked about the collective idea, and this is, he Twittered me, he says, it's amazing how much you can learn as a collective when you get rid of the notion that all knowledge must come from the instructor. That's one of my students who said that. And that was something, when I talked to them about being social and learning from each other, it was a pretty foreign thing. I mean, they had done it, but not in the intentional ways that I had asked them to do. And I asked my students two questions, and this is part of their grade that they have to answer at the end of the year. And I asked them, what did you contribute to the learning of others? And secondly, how did you learn from others in the class? And so they have to actually provide a narrative for me. They can do it in all kinds of ways. And think deeply about, how did I learn from other people? Was it just you? Who did it? Oh, and I mean, they come up with these amazing, you know, when they start being reflective around this, I get responses like, well, I met so-and-so in the hallway and we had this discussion about that. Or they left a comment on my blog. Or when we were doing the online thing in the chat room, somebody said something that really was struck me. So just having them be intentional about thinking about that stuff makes them understand how important social learning is. My question, what if you asked your students that and you made that a requirement? And that can happen in first grade, that can happen in 12th, it doesn't matter. Should that not be an important, were you going to say something, Brian?
I was just going to say, we brought this in, it comes out of open space meetings where one of the rules, that's actually only one rule of the meeting, is if you're not learning or contributing, you have to go somewhere where you are. So a lot of 2 feet, right? So we put that in as just a general classroom thing. So when students are there, if maybe they're just tired because they're sick, or you know, they're sad because their pet died the day before, I go up to them and say, are you learning or contributing? They'll say, nope. And I'll say, then you can go upstairs and just read a book or chill out. Or it'll refocus the kid. Go, yeah, I'm right, I've got to do another 2 things. So it's a very powerful.
And I mean, it's just being intentional about those things, right? It's just making sure that that's a clear expectation. Again, this idea that we're going to come together in a room and not be responsible for each other. If you really believe in this idea of learning communities, this whole conference is about learning communities, we need to figure out ways to make that more than just sort of a fancy term that flies around. How do we make that intentional? So some of the ways that we do that in my classroom anyways is, and again, this is with the pre-service teachers, is they have a blog. So every student has a blog, and they write, and this whole idea of being reflective about their learning, again, that's not an easy thing to teach. And you'd think, well, these are teachers, potential teachers. This is hard stuff. Thinking about their practice, writing that out. It takes a while to kind of get the hang of it. And some, I have to say, after 4 months, don't really do it. Others, yeah, they're pretty well on their way. They're doing it. They're getting close. Then the deeper learning comes with the comments. I mean, blogs, the reason that we blog is because blogs, I believe, are about conversation. So I want to converse, talk. And, you know, they get some really, and again, I bring in, there's this nice mix in that it's largely each other, but occasionally I can get other people from my network, or and they get some from their network that can come in and make comments and leave feedback. And again, this becomes, you know, a really critical part of their learning, because it's not just about, oh, nice, I like what you wrote. They're pushing each other's thinking, and so that it really becomes the learning community that we want. Even inside our synchronous meetings, we have a back channel, so there's that conversation that's going on all the time. They're learning with each other, again, asking each other's questions, not just asking me. And you know, it's interesting how once they get sort of this freedom to know that they can actually make a contribution, they're dropping in links of things. And I mean, it starts to get really interesting after a while. And then again, the nice thing is with the technology that you can save that entire transcript of all the chats that have gone on, and they can go back and look at that later on and say, oh yeah, so-and-so posted this link or asked this question, and now I can begin to think about it when I want to. Sometimes we'll use a space like a Ning or a Moodle where they can have a specific threaded discussion, and so just another way for that social learning to happen. Alright, I just want to do a little update on the task here and see if indeed there was any contributions here. So this was sent out, here's all the pictures of weather today from around the world. That's mine. So starting here and going up. So in a little while, we had quite a few little contributions about weather around the world. So that's kind of cool, I think. So again, talked about a lot of things this morning. I just want to close by saying, and I love this slide, that teaching isn't rocket science, it's more complex and demanding. And I agree with this statement. But I would add that being willing to get rid of the walls in your classroom and build bridges and connections for your students is, while certainly complex, is far more rewarding than rocket science. Anyways, thank you.